Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update. Gemar Chasima Tova, Mr. Honlein.
Gemar Chasima Tova to you, to everyone. Let's hope it will be a peaceful, healthy, and happy year for everyone.
Oh, you could say that again, that's for sure. I want to remind everybody that on the 15th of October, the 50th anniversary tribute gala brought to you by the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations takes place in New York City. Everybody is invited to come and attend to support the fund and to be at the Waldorf Astoria on Park Avenue in New York City that very night, Tuesday, October the 15th. I've been begging Malcolm for an invitation. He says one might be forthcoming. Maybe if more and more JMN listeners come forward with reservations, he won't hesitate to have me there that night. So please, folks, I'm begging you, reserve and make sure you're there at the Waldorf Astoria. The event will, of course, honor the guests of honor, who are all the past conference chairs, including, especially, I should say, with emphasis on the last 20 years, since the last tribute gala was 20 years ago. And, of course, Malcolm will be recognized for his more than 25 years at the helm of the conference and for 40 years of leadership in the American Jewish community and world jury. Information about the whole thing, you can contact the Conference of Presidents. You could do so by by email, gala2013@conferenceofpresidents.org. Again, gala2013@conferenceofpresidents.org. Hope it's going well, Malcolm, because we're getting closer and closer, you know.
It's getting very close, and given the numbers of days of Yontif in between, we're almost there. And gala is G-A-L-A 2013, and we hope that we'll be able to announce before the dinner that we're sold out, but right now there's still a chance for people to get in, and even a seat for you, Nachum. We're working on commission, you know, for the number of people from JMD.
Well, that would be the case. I'd be able to bring everybody. Anyway,
have everybody identify. And
I also want to mention that Malcolm is arranging, we'll have some of the chairs of the conference with us. We don't know if we'll do it on a Friday. Another day we'll figure it out, but we'll certainly get a perspective on recent American and world Jewish history through the words of some of the past conference chairs. You mentioned to me a large percentage of people in Israel who are fasting on Yom Kippur. I wanted to mention to you that we, as you know, we have our news from Israel, straight from Israel every morning. And to hear that newscast begin with the words, Gemar Chatima Tova, to hear the woman radio announcer, the news reader, emphasize the story of what the temperature will be on Yom Kippur, because so many people are fasting, to go through, for her to go through toward the end of the newscast, the ending times of the fast. By the way, Haifa is 7:24. The ending times of the fast for tomorrow. Malcolm, if you would have said any of this to anybody in previous generations, certainly 3-4 generations back, they would have thought you were nuts. Now we have a state of Israel with a broadcast authority that's emphasizing on Erev Yom Kippurim those types of things. Sometimes you have to just sit back and take it all in, if you know what I mean.
I agree. It's the kind of things we take for granted, that while we can criticize that the state isn't religious enough, and others criticize it, sometimes for being too religious, but basically the criticism that comes from often from our communities, and we overlook the reality. And this year it takes on greater interest, in the sense that this is the 40th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War, and we all recall, those who are old enough, what that Yom Kippur turned into and the price that was paid, etc. And the fact that 3/4 of Israelis fast and even more attend synagogue, and that there is this desire to identify in a religious way, and that the whole state comes to an absolute standstill, but absolute. And it's very widespread, that the people accept this and identify. People I know who are not religious in ritual ways prepare for this, and they prepare for how they're going to break the Tanis at the fast at the end, and the investment of people in this that started already early in the week, it is because it's a Jewish state and you live a Jewish calendar.
100%. And I'm glad you mentioned that about coming to a standstill, because that was another story in our newscast this morning, warning everybody the exact time that bus and rail service will end throughout the entire country. How amazing is that? I may have more details on this next week, as will a lot of other people, because supposedly, now that it's 40 years, certain information will be coming out. Are we going to learn a lot about the Yom Kippur War that up until this point we had not known?
I don't think so. I you know, always with Tom, you get clarity in papers and documents, and people write their memoirs, etc. But I don't think there's that much more to come out.
Yeah, apparently the 40-year mark is a significant one in terms of releasing documents, etc.
Yes.
So, but you're not
all along. Those documents have been made public, and people have been aware of a lot of it.
All right, a lot going on, as you know, and we'd love to get some clarity in terms of what's been happening over the last couple of weeks. I don't mean to be cynical, but we're trying to analyze things here. It does seem that the President of the United States wanted to take a strong position against Syria and certainly project a certain image. He may also have known, I don't know if he did or did not, he may also have known that it would be difficult to win the support of Congress, the numbers bear it out, and to win the support of the American people. I think the media probably bears that out. He goes to the United States, he goes to the people, rather, this week, and states his case in terms of action against Syria or potential action, and concludes that it will be some type of agreement or cooperation with the Russians that will determine whether in the long run the U.S. does take any action or not. Does it make sense that the president was trying to utilize the last couple of weeks to project a strong image while knowing deep down that he would not have support to carry it out?
I would say that it's hard to say at this time. Maybe it'll take 40 years. But I doubt it. I think we'll know a lot more a lot earlier. And having been engaged with people in the administration in discussions of this, I don't believe that they planned it long term. I think that the president saw that he wasn't going to win in the House, or and that the votes in the, both in Congress generally, the opposition that he was hearing, was an incentive for them to look for an option. Whether this was a Russian idea proposed by Russia without any pre-consultation, or a joint idea or an American idea that was proposed to them, and it took time either for them to accept or for some details to be worked out, or the Russians took advantage of a situation where they saw America hanging on the ropes, and to be able to save Assad's position, that he stay in office, that they agreed to this. What is clear is that, A, this is not over. The Syrians put new conditions that there be no arms to the rebels from the United States, and we know that 2 weeks ago the CIA started providing light weapons, the communications vehicle equipment and vehicles, that they want to see what the who will be the beneficiary of this. Initially, it's, of course, I think, Assad. Question is, in the next stage, is what will we find? And what happens to the other parties? What happens to Saudi Arabia? Kuwait and Qatar signed with the White House. Now they see the U.S. backing off again. Will they see this, the Saudis see this, as America again not showing the resolve and not showing the ability to implement the, quote, robust international response that the White House had called for? These are all very open questions. And of course, the implications for Iran, how Iran views this, what does this mean for that situation, which we talk about, because there are changes there, right, too, including expediting of facilities, etc., and new outreach by Rouhani, which I think is a subterfuge. But so the implications that we look at when we in this situation are much broader, and you have to look at how do you really do this? How do you secure the sites? How do you destroy them? What happens to the weapons that went to his chemical weapons that went to Hezbollah, right, or the Shiba, the Shabiha, which is the some of the militia? I mean, there are a lot of
We know,
and you see already that Syria put its air force back in action in the suburbs of Damascus after not having flown for a long time, because I think that they see these new opportunities as presenting them with a chance to escalate the violence.
This audience is quite concerned about the following. I mean, this is the feeling I'm getting. We see the numbers in Congress, the projections, if there would in fact be a vote, how things would go. We see the media and, quote-unquote, the American people and what the reaction is to action against Syria. But our question is, what about American Jewish leadership? What does AIPAC say about an Obama decision to White House decision to go ahead and take military action against Syria? What does the Conference of Presidents say on the issue? How has Jewish leadership weighed in on this?
Well, we have supported the idea that there has to be a response to the use of chemical weapons. This is something that should have been done a long time ago. There were at least 12 instances over the past year when chemical weapons were used. But as one official said, well, only 10 people were killed, or small numbers were killed each time. Yeah, but if you stopped it then, you wouldn't have come to the situation we faced.
Right.
That once you open the gate to the use of chemical weapons, weapons of mass destruction, this gives a license to everybody who both has these kind of weapons, which are dastardly and were outlawed after their use in World War I. They are very brutal, horrific, as we saw in the pictures that emerged from the attack. I know there are people who still aren't sure, and the Russians are certainly pushing the line that these came from the rebels, areas that they checked the trajectories, etc. But the United States and others are very convinced that this was, in fact, a Syrian government attack. And they certainly have these large stockpiles, which they had denied till now, but now they agree they're going to destroy them, the things that they didn't really have. And so our response was not to support a specific piece of legislation or urge that people go to war. What we say is that this is an international norm. And once you violate it, and especially after the president puts prestige in the position of the United States on the line with his statement about a red line, and announced that he was going to Congress, it was essential that the message to everyone in the Middle East be very clear, and not just the Middle East, and that the violation of that kind of a principle would be a red light, a green light to everybody in the region. And there has to be, and it wasn't a question of choosing a side about the outcome, because there's no good outcome. There's no good parties today in the Middle East that are likely to take over in Syria. You have a competition of a lot of outside forces. You have thousands of foreigners there. You have such a complicated situation that we've tried to address over the last year or 2 years, explaining why those details you see become relevant during this last week.
Is Assad's position stronger than when we last spoke a couple of weeks ago?
I would say it's stronger than it was a week ago. I think he sounded very confident when he went on those television reports, even though, you know, a lot of what he said I don't think could be justified or verified. I think that it raises a lot of questions amongst others in the region, and the fact is that Russia, I think, emerges out of this stronger and in a better position. And an argument that Putin put forward and that I reported here a long time ago, which is that he says, you may not like my choice of friends, but you see, I'm loyal to them,
yeah.
And that the West is not.
And because of that loyalty, how can we trust him on this potential agreement to let him go and seek out and destroy chemical weaponry arsenals in Syria?
You absolutely can't, and this is why what Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify.
Right.
This has to be... I don't even know if it's feasible. I don't know if it's possible to actually do it, to carry it out. You might be able to position people. It's hard to move these things. Some of them are in binary storage, meaning that the components are stored, but it doesn't become a chemical weapon until you put them together. Some of it is in shells. There isn't a long life on these things. You have to change the containers. You have to sustain it, maintain it. Moving it would also be very difficult, and it's probably in 50 different locations. We know that he moved it around after when the threat came up, and we know that he moved stuff into the Alawite area because that was going to be his protection if, in fact, they had to resort to retreating to the Alawite enclave that they created. These chemical weapons would have been his front line of defense against an attack by government, what might be then government forces or still rebel forces or whatever.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program. Heard and listened to sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial. Around the world on the web, jmnam.org, the Conference of Presidents 50th Anniversary Tribute Gala is October the 15th. We recommend circling your calendar for the Waldorf Astoria. Information, Gala 2013 at conferenceofpresidents.org. Gala 2013 at conferenceofpresidents.org. And I also want to take this opportunity to thank Yated Ne'eman. It's a newspaper that's well known in certain parts of our community, and they have been, again, for another year, have been transcribing the conversations I have with Malcolm Honlein in their newspaper. And a lot of people enjoy reading it. A lot of people can't catch the show in audio form, so they actually read it over the weekend. And we thank them and wish them a happy, healthy, and sweet new year. Are we officially, is the United States officially funding the opposition in Syria? Because the accusations that we are continue to come from that area, of course, from the Assad regime. But have we ever made an official declaration in terms of financial support?
We have been giving humanitarian aid, and we have said that. It seems the military aid, according to reports, has only been in recent weeks, and nobody knew who you send it to. Who do you give the weapons to? So you have the Free Syrian Army, which is supposedly pro-Western, but others say ineffective. You have 100 groups fighting in Syria. All of them, the vast majority of them, not ones, as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs said, that will be pro-American or groups we would want to see take over. You have the increasing influence of Al-Qaeda and certainly of al-Nusra and the Al-Qaeda of the Levant in Iraq. You have these guys who've come from Europe, from all over, to fight there. We have to think about what's going to happen to them afterward. So the United States has delayed and tried to build international coalitions and has tried to mobilize international support. But the fact is that in all this time, I don't think we build our credibility, and it raises many questions about what to be done. But the fact is that the situation is so complicated that there is no easy there's no one party you can point to and say, oh, those are the good guys, those are guys we want to be associated with.
I saw an interview with one of the masked rebels, you know, they don't want to be identified, so, you know, they wear a mask during these TV interviews, and he basically says, I would love for the U.S. to attack Assad, our enemy to attack our enemy. We love when people who we hate go up against people who we hate. And I'm saying to myself, that this is who we're funding or potentially funding.
Well, there are a lot of people who say that's what they would like to see, that Assad and these guys fight it out and both win.
Right, yeah. We've seen that in history. There have been plenty of those, right? Israel, how have they reacted politically? Obviously, we'll talk about Iran and everything that Israel has to prepare for and continue to prepare for. But politically, I'm sure it's very difficult for the prime minister and other ministers to decide what to say publicly. What have they said over the last couple of weeks?
Almost nothing. I have to say it's the most disciplined I remember seeing Israeli governments in a difficult situation. We had a conference call with Bennett, and even he in this, and said that there is a policy, and he could only make certain comments on it. But if you notice, the response has been very muted. The Prime Minister has made statements about the danger and try to keep the focus on the major threat, which is Iran.
Right.
And the fact that Rouhani now is taking this charm offensive and will come to New York and may try to, you know, introduce their parallel process, but knowing that he has said and others have said they're going to go ahead no matter what with their nuclear weapons program. So for Israel, that's the major focus that they want to sustain. They also are very worried about what's going on in Egypt and the Sinai, so Israel has a lot of fronts to be concerned about, but I think that they have the luxury this time of being able to stand back because there is no party that really threatens Israel at this moment. What I said a couple weeks ago here and told people not to worry about going, and there was this panic setting in. There's just no one who would dare, I think, today, other than terrorist attack or local violence, that will dare to challenge Israel, because for Assad, he knows it'll be his last day in office. For Iran, they know it's the end of their nuclear program. For Hezbollah, they know what the response will be. So there's no one really in a position to carry out a serious attack against Israel.
Would you be saying things? Would you change your mind if the U.S. took military action against Syria? Because we've heard the threats from Iranian officials that, if in fact, the U.S. does take any action against Syria, the first victim of theirs will be Israel.
Yeah, but I don't see what the response would be. Could you have some rockets from Hezbollah or other groups there? Yes. Could you have some escalation along the borders? Yes. Do I think that Israel is prepared and would respond very forcefully in a way that I think would be convincing to others not to do it? You know, the USS San Antonio docked in Haifa with 800 Marines and helicopters and other equipment on board.
Is it still there now?
It's there, and actually they were given crew leave, which is the first time in a long time that an American ship has docked in Haifa. Those 800 don't include the crew, so it's a very large contingent that came off and said very positive things of their visit there. And we've had the joint exercises with the United States and Israel. You heard the president's comment in the speech about Israel's overwhelming power to respond.
Right.
And that is an important message Israel wanted to get out, that don't think you're going to take...
And no doubt asked him to include it, right?
And to... I would say that would be a safe guess.
or you may have asked him to include it.
That they take a strong stand, that Israel will have the right and will be prepared.
Right.
And they are. I think that they've taken all the necessary precautions.
By the way, we should mention that, especially because we're not going to, unless, God forbid, there's an emergency, where obviously we'd connect and speak on the air, but otherwise we won't speak for a few weeks. We should mention that the Prime Minister of Israel, as you told us last time, will be one of the scheduled speakers right after Yontif at the UN meeting in New York.
On the 29th, most likely, he will be here. It will be after a lot of the heads of state have left, but it will be still a critical thing. And look, the UN will now be the focus of attention, with Rouhani will be coming, and I think he won't give the same kind of speech as Ahmadinejad, but we shouldn't be fooled. People have to keep the focus correct and make sure that through our contacts with elected officials and media that we do not lose sight of the reality that Iran is moving ahead all the time. And now that Russia talks about selling him the S-300, five systems of this very advanced and hard-to-beat air defense system, and to Syria as well. So those who think that, you know, Russia's playing this very peaceful role, they're making a lot of money out of these deals. They take $1 billion out of Syria. They're taking much more out of Iran and building a new reactor at Bushehr for them, a second reactor. The S-300 is a very capable system, and it will affect civilian flights within Israel's border as well, if it's operational in Syria. Until now, it has not been. And the Iranians, at the same time, say, quote, we will not give up one iota of our absolute nuclear rights. So they're playing the same duplicitous game. He'll come in a better suit than Ahmadinejad wore, but fundamentals don't change.
And was he the one who issued New Year's greetings to Israel, or was that another official in Iran?
Well, there were two. One was a comment he made. One was Zarif, the foreign minister, but they later denied that...
they denied giving New Year's greetings.
That they denied giving the New Year's greeting. Maybe they gave it, but they didn't mean for everybody. It was only for certain Jews, and only Jews in Iran, not the Jews everywhere, which was what the quote was, but maybe they didn't know that it was really for Jews of Rosh Hashanah. It wasn't for everybody.
When they said everywhere, they meant everywhere in Iran.
they have backed off of it. Although people jumped all over it initially, and it is troubling that people don't learn the lessons. And now they see that Russia, I think, emerges, as I said, much stronger, showing that it's a reliable ally, puts more ships into the Mediterranean, is building up a more robust position. It reaches out to Saudi Arabia and others, although there are obvious tensions and big differences. Saudi Arabia wanted the attack to go ahead right away.
I mean, are they mortal enemies, Syria and Saudi Arabia, or not?
Well, it works on a couple bases. One is that they still see the Russians as atheists and communists, despite Putin's op-ed and talking about God created us all equally, but it's the God he doesn't believe in who did that. And they have had certain meetings and stuff, but I think that some of it was contentious. They're not exactly on the same page. But you see that Russia has emerged, even in regard to Egypt, where they said, told the Egyptian generals they will make up the arms they lose, because the Russians are very much against the Muslim Brotherhood. A lot of the places think the United States is soft on the Muslim Brotherhood or cozies up to the Muslim Brotherhood, whether it was in Egypt and other places. I don't think that that is the policy, but it certainly may be the perception or the outcome or the actual things on the ground, unintentional or intentional, that we have become identified as supportive. Our support for the rebels doesn't help in that regard because, as I said, that the rebels are overwhelmingly extremists and bad guys.
All right, so I understand the Russian position. It's stronger, the perception in the world, I'm sure everyone thinks so, but what do you say to the armchair political quarterbacks who sit back in, you know, in this area and talk about how the U.S. is now a laughingstock to the world? Is that too harsh of a term? Would you say that it's a little bit more parve than that?
Well, I would say that the United States is standing in the regard in which we're held and will depend on the outcome of what is going on now to a large degree. It has been diminished, there's no doubt. I don't think after Libya, after some of the other situations, our relationships, for instance, with Russia were greatly deteriorated.
So you think the president thinks he blew it a bit? I mean, do you think that would he do it differently if he had it to do over again?
That is a very good question. He may not have said the red line. He may not have moved so quickly to a congressional vote, not knowing what the outcome would be. I don't think that he could not react to the chemical weapons attack. I think people who say this don't get the implications and understand why this is a critical action. It was all along, but it is certainly now that we send a message to every terrorist group, everybody, that it's open season, you can do what you want. Look, Assad could come out of this much stronger and I don't know, reinforce his position, or it could sustain the war for a long time, or it could lead to some effort to try and bring peace or negotiate a peace. I don't see the grounds in which that would take place. And remember, there are other implications. What about what's going on in the Sinai over the last week and 2 weeks of the escalation of violence, et cetera? And
has it led to a stronger Israeli military presence there?
Along
the border?
The Gaza-Sinai border, absolutely. And it's what's more important, it's a huge increase in the Egyptian military presence. They have more than 2,000 soldiers now operating against the terrorists in the Rafah area primarily. Israel's defense has been doing a very good job, that defense that Israel built along the Egyptian border and the Sinai border. And in fact, now the guys who used to smuggle weapons into Israel are going through Jordan to get them into the Palestinian refugee camps primarily. But there's an estimate now that under Morsi, the number of terrorists in Sinai grew from about 1,500 to 2,000 to 7,000. According to, this is Al Hayat, Egyptian TV, talked about this and gave some specific reasons why these numbers they think were valid. You've had soldiers killed every day. You've had the counterattacks. Probably more than 100 terrorists were killed in this time. But what they're looking at is a situation where you've had this buildup of 15 groups, six of them Al-Qaeda, many others, the influx of huge amounts of weapons, and Egypt saw that it's hurting them. So Egypt, number one, went after Gaza, closed a lot of the tunnels. The economy in Gaza, Hamas's economy, is in free fall. They've lost the money and support from Qatar, largely. Iran cut them off because of their position on Syria, so that they don't have the same income. In fact, they're importing commodities from Israel, and they are looking to other sources for funding. Egypt built a buffer zone, is building a buffer zone along its border with Gaza, and this means that the people can't leave. They put restrictions on movement. Then Hamas guys have gone into the Sinai. You have at least 600, 700 operating there. A lot of the people that Egypt has captured or killed were, in fact, Hamas operatives working with these terrorist organizations.
You don't even know what faction to be part of if you want to keep your life, if you don't want to get killed.
That's true. And then there is a movement within Gaza. It's nascent. It's just in initial stages, but I think could be serious, and I think that's where a lot of the international effort should be put into building up this group against Hamas, sort of like the group that went against Morsi.
Right.
But the situation at Sinai, which I don't know, we'll talk about for a year, trying to get people to focus on it, and nobody wants to pay attention. This is a cancerous situation. This is really dangerous. Yesterday, Egypt moved against 55,000 unlicensed preachers. There are at least 2,000 Islamists that they've arrested. And instead of condemning them, we have to understand what the government, this current government, is has to do in order to restabilize the country to prevent a takeover again by the Islamists.
Right.
This is an important shift in the region, and they have the backing of the Saudis. They have the backing of even, I think, Qatar has moved on this issue, and certainly the UAE and others. They're providing weapons and money to help stabilize the situation there.
All right, I got a couple of things here because the clock is moving and there's so many curiosities I have. The rioting on Har HaBayit on Rosh Hashanah, which supposedly, from what I read, led to rock throwing on those who were davening at the Kotel on Rosh Hashanah in Israel. Do you have an update on that whole situation?
I saw some of the reports. Israel's worked to limit the access, and especially of Jews, to Har HaBayit. And the, it doesn't take much to set off rock throwing up there. They have huge piles of rocks and stones. I don't know why they don't force them to remove all of these so that you don't have the potential for the kind of assaults that we saw.
But were there injuries? Like, was it a severe?
There wasn't. There were no serious injuries.
And speaking of places like Har HaBayit, I believe I read this, and I know that you can confirm it certainly if it's true. Was it a 7th century discovery this week in Israel?
I think this is another one of those cases, Nachum, which you know I go crazy about.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't understand how people aren't jumping out of their skins again and sit down with your kids and tell them about this amazing discovery. You want them to have bitachon and emunah. You want them to understand. You want to see the truth of Tanakh. You want to see the verification, the validation. This is such an amazing discovery. It's the first time that something like this was found. It was 30, 40 feet from the Kotel. It's at the new excavations that are going on by Professor Mazar at the in Ir David, and people have seen some of the amazing things that she's found. But this is truly amazing. It was in one location. It was many, many pieces of gold, and they believed that these were all ornaments for a Sefer Torah. This is 641 BCE.
Wow.
And these were the medallion that they found in very good condition. You have to ask, why was it preserved all this time? It was hidden in the floor underneath the floorboards, or equivalent of floorboards. And the medallion shows a menorah, a 7-branch menorah with a high pedestal, again, proving the debate, a shofar, and a Sefer Torah. And this was, it's 2,600 years ago, 2,700 years ago. And you see the continuity, the validity, you see it there in the most concrete way possible. And they say that this medallion was used as an ornament for a Sefer Torah. Was like a breastplate on a Sefer Torah. And you see many other things that she found. Now, this is one little postage stamp. The whole area, you know, is not a block in New York terms. And every day they're finding such amazing things.
So it's not 7th century. It's 7th century BCE.
BCE.
Yeah. We're going a lot further back than that. Unbelievable.
It is. And it's not. It's just one of many. So this one got attention because it's so remarkable. And it's so exciting to people.
On this Erev Yom Kippur, think about it. Think about what was going on tomorrow on the anniversary of all those Yemei HaKippurim from centuries ago in that era. And here we are. I think, by the way, and I've said this to you before, and I think you agree, whoever does the marketing for the Archaeological Society of Israel, that their timing is impeccable. It seems that Erev Yom Kippur, Erev Chanukah, they seem to be very, very out there with the brand new news about their discoveries.
It's Bashert.
I love it. And I hate
that's a coincidence. I mean, believe me, they don't plan it. Maybe they held it up to verify.
You know what? You're right. You're right. I shouldn't say that, but we have joked about it in the past, especially I know around Erev Chanukah time. And finally, I'm sorry for bringing this up, but and it's probably improper for me to bring it up, and it's probably even more improper for you to comment about it, but I'm going to take a chance anyway. I had a little bit of satisfaction. Not that I was endorsing anybody, and certainly you don't endorse anybody we know, But I was somewhat satisfied that members of our community who became well known for improper behavior, absurd behavior, and obscene behavior were defeated this week at the polls. I don't know if you want to say anything about that or not. I do want to ask you, I'm sure, hey, if we know him well, then you must know him extra well. We know the likely Democratic candidate for Mayor Bill de Blasio very well. Lots of stuff you could tell us about his relationship with the Jewish community. But do you know Joe Loda at all?
I actually met him this week for the first time, and he has many Jewish backers and has had an association. Even people think that his mother may have been Jewish. But I can't verify it. I haven't verified it. I just heard it, actually. I worked with Bill de Blasio, who did work on the issue of sanctions and the press conference, other things, sanctions against Iran.
That's right. Plus the Saudi Arabian Airline case recently and all that, right?
Had a long relationship over the years with the Jewish community and with involvement in certain issues.
So it should be an interesting race.
It'll be very interesting. I think that the choices will be very clear, that right. People have to get involved. I think the fact that Chaim Deutsch won in Brooklyn was a very important statement because of the way the gerrymandering of districts
right.
divided up the Jewish communities, and the fact that people across everybody thought that it's because it's a Russian district, they all vote one way for a Russian Jewish American Jewish candidate. In fact, he won in a very important race, and it shows again that when people turn out and people get involved, that there are black candidates that Orthodox Jews lined up to vote for and Jewish communities generally lined up to vote for. There are Jewish candidates that the black communities lined up to vote for. I think we see the breakdown of a lot of the, it's not an elimination of it, and there were a lot of appeals to racial identity or religious identity or ethnic identity, which is just natural in politics.
Right.
But we also saw a lot of situations where this crossed. So,
want to comment on my initial statement
about the yes? I think that it is an important statement, and
right.
The fact that they were Jewish or not, I think, is an irrelevant.
Right, but it's more sensitive to us, obviously.
The question of the message we send.
Right.
I believe in forgiveness, and I think that people, make mistakes, and if they overcome them and
right.
do what's necessary, you don't eliminate them, but. I think there is a message in the fact that this would always be an overhang, that they will always have the late night comedians will have enough material.
Right. And especially because they didn't really pay a price. I mean, in one case, maybe you could say it, but you know what I mean. There was not like, nobody did.
Nobody went to jail.
Right, nobody did time for their actions.
Nobody did,
right.
and I don't know that it rose to the.
Right, understood.
To do that.
Right.
But, now we'll see.
Right.
We've got to look at the quality of the candidates. Who can really serve? The city is going to face tough issues. The state will, and America will. And I tell people all the time: don't take glee when you see political leaders you don't agree with being embarrassed or being hurt. When America is hurt, we're hurt,
100%.
Like everybody else. And 100%. Israel is hurt.
Right.
Israel needs a strong America.
Well, you know who I'm voting for mayor, right? Whichever one shows up on October 15th to the Conference of Presidents 50th Anniversary Tribute Gala. Simple
actually,
as that.
A good criteria. I didn't think of it, but I will. I'll have to make sure they get invited so you can make a fair judgment.
That's right. Oh, you mean if both show up, I'm going to have to actually make a decision?
Actually, we haven't invited either, so I don't know that it's a fair judgment.
Malcolm, I wish you an easy fast, a Gmarch Simatova. Enjoy your JM and the AM break, and we'll have plenty to talk about in early October when we reconvene. As I always say, we only reconvene in between if, God forbid, there's an emergency. So in this case, I'll say, I hope it is a few weeks till we speak again.
Well, I wish everybody an easy fast, a meaningful fast. Easy isn't always the best answer, but a meaningful one.
Right.
And that have a great Yontif, and that we will have peace in this period, and that everybody can go to Yerushalayim and celebrate in peace and safety, and that we look forward to a better and a really good new year for everyone.
100%. A wonderful 5774. May we be inscribed in the Book of Life and health and sustenance. In a world of peace. Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.